What's up, you spooky bitches? We are back in business with another episode of the Hello Sydney podcast coming at you, a podcast for horror lovers where we discuss any and all things horror, and it's me, your host, Sydney. You know me, you love me, or at least I assume you do if you've been listening to me for this long, because honestly, I don't know how you do it sometimes. Just kidding, love you back. Hi, how's everybody's day? What's everybody been up to? What's new? What's exciting? Watched any good horror movies lately? I don't think I've watched any, like, crazy good movies lately, but what I did watch, and I binged it in one sitting, because like the episodes are short and shit, whatever. Baby Reindeer. What the fuck was that? That shit was fucking insane. If you haven't watched it, it's this show on Netflix, and it's written by this dude named Richard Gadd about his real life experience with a stalker. And the crazy part about it is Richard Gadd also plays the main character. So I'm like, dude, imagine like the trauma this guy is going through to relive these fucking situations. Good for him, solely for our entertainment. Martha was an absolute like crazy person. However, I did really feel bad at the end when she leaves that call about like why she calls him Baby Reindeer. Like, I kind of teared up a little bit. I'm like, I should not be sympathizing with the stalker here, right? Like, this, I feel kind of fucked up. Like, this is a moral dilemma. So yeah, that was cool. Check that out if you're into that sort of thing. Tonight I'm going to be watching Infested, that new spider movie that's on Shudder. Everybody's telling me that because another spider movie came out this year, which was Sting, which I really enjoyed, but from what I've heard, everybody's saying that Infested is actually better. So I'm really looking forward to that. So I'm going to get through this so I can go do that. So today we're talking about a movie that a lot of people like will refer to as one of the more disturbing films that they've ever seen. And I think people say that because it just seems so real. And if you haven't seen it, you'll understand what I mean by that by the end of this episode. But it's called The Poughkeepsie Tapes, and it was originally released in 2007. Actually, it was supposed to be released in 2007. However, it was pulled from its release without any real explanation. But then it received its first limited release 7 years later. So this actually wasn't even available to the public until 2014. And then in 2017, 10 full years after this movie was actually supposed to come out, it got a DVD Blu-ray release. So this movie actually wasn't made available to the public for several years. So it was just sitting there for a really long time. And when it came out, obviously, again, it didn't have a theatrical release. So it kind of really flew under the radar. And people didn't really know about this unless you were in circles of the horror community. And I know that's personally how I heard about this movie, because I've talked about this on here before. If you haven't heard me talk about it yet, I was like Tumblr famous, LOL, back when I was like 16. It wasn't even Tumblr famous. I had like 30,000 followers, but I had a horror movie Tumblr. And I'm so grateful for that to this day, because I found out about so many movies through having that Tumblr and just through like being in the horror community. And one of the movies that I found out about during that time was The Poughkeepsie Tapes. And at the time I watched it, probably was actually about 2014 when it did get that release. And it was pretty fucking shocking. It was. And I almost feel like it being released in 2014, though it was made in like the earlier 2000s, was almost more effective, because it's really gritty and grainy. And it just, it's almost, it feels like kind of unnatural to be watching. It just feels very real. So that release happened, and then again, it's still kind of flown under the radar even for people in the horror community. But when I was reading and doing some research about this, I wasn't on TikTok in 2020. I didn't start my TikTok until 2021, which I know at that time Megan Is Missing, which is another movie that people refer to as one of the more disturbing ones. I know that went viral on TikTok probably like 2021, 2022, because I had a video about it that went viral, and there were some other ones at the time. But from what I read, in 2020, The Poughkeepsie Tapes actually went viral on TikTok. So a lot of new people were introduced to it. And it was mainly because the way it was circulating, people were making it sound like it was a snuff film. Hate to break it to you if you thought that was true, but it is not. This is not a snuff film. In fact, the writer and director of this movie is a man named John Eric Dowdle, and you might know him for being the director of As Above, So Below, which is a huge movie, as well as Devil from 2010, which is a personal favorite. And he also actually did Quarantine from 2008. He also wrote As Above, So Below, which if you've listened to my episode on that, you know like how much thought and effort was put into writing that because of the parallels to Dante's Inferno and whatnot. So what I'm trying to get across is this guy is an actual like smart and very well respected and very good horror director, he did not make a fucking snuff film. Okay, so The Poughkeepsie Tapes is not a snuff film. Maybe I should have saved that for the end, but I'm telling you now. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make with this is people do believe that this movie is disturbing, and I totally can understand why, because again, it has very graphic depictions of like bondage and torture and assault, child abuse, child kidnapping, anything that you can imagine. So if that's the type of stuff that you like to stay away from, then this episode might not be for you. But if that's the type of stuff that you like to stay away from and that you don't want to actually watch it, but you want to know what it's about, then this is exactly the episode for you, because we're just going to dive right into it. So the style of this movie, it's almost kind of like Hell House, which I did in the last episode. So it kind of intertwines the found footage aspect of things with some like police interviews and stuff about the case that's going on. So this movie opens with like a montage, and what we see during that montage is cars driving into a cemetery. This includes a hearse, so obviously it's some sort of funeral. We see a woman walking with like with flowers and whatnot, and we see home videos of this young girl, and this young girl ends up being somebody named Cheryl Dempsey. And the first words that we get is one of the FBI agents or police officers, whatever, that's interviewing. He says how the story of Cheryl Dempsey is the strangest and most disturbing case that I've ever seen, and I've been doing this for 25 years. Then we cut back to that cemetery. However, now it's nighttime and we have kind of a strange angle. Like you can tell that there's like a camera on the ground, and we see some guy like tying a rope to something, and it looks like the ground is dug up, and he ties a rope to something, and then he gets in a car. We hear the door close and we hear him start to drive away. And out of that dug up hole, a body is dragged out. So whoever this person was just completely grave robbed a body. And that's when we get our opening credits. So we get our opening credits, The Poughkeepsie Tapes, and it says part one, The Tapes. So first interview we see is with this woman who is explaining how she had a tenant that lived in this house, and this house is where the Poughkeepsie Tapes were found. But then we cut to a couple different like field agents. So one of them, his name is like Leonard Schway or something, and he's like, we had no idea what we were dealing with at that time. And then we cut to another guy who's like the video analyst for the FBI, and he's explaining how he's the one that had to watch all of the videos that were found, and there was a significant number of tapes found in this home. We get an interview with an FBI profiler who says through looking at these tapes and kind of understanding this case, he understands that torturing and killing turned this killer on. And at times he would actually have to stop mid-act or like mid-kill, mid-torture to switch tapes. So he had enough restraint to be able to do that. We switch back to the analyst, and he's explaining how his wife ended up watching one of the tapes one night. And she only watched about like a half an hour. But he goes on to say that what is on those tapes is just so horrific. And she was so uncomfortable and so disturbed by it that she did not let him touch her for a year. So we cut back to the house, and the landlord's like, yeah, they found the tapes in this closet. And then, yeah, over here, you know. So we know that they found more than just tapes in the house, but we'll get to that later. So then one of the police officers or FBI agents, whatever, is explaining about all the bodies that they found in the yard of this home. So they're like, yeah, we found a woman here, another one here, another one here. We found a couple and their 10-month-old baby here. They were all killed in a horrific manner. So like, this just shows that this dude doing this has no victim pool, because they're also explaining like, yeah, it was like a woman here, a man here, like whatever. And you can tell he's just whoever he can get his fucking hands on. You can already tell this guy is sadistic as fuck. So then we see the analyst guy standing in front of the row of tapes, and it's a very, very long row of tapes. There's like hundreds of these things. And he goes, from here to about here is all tapes of Cheryl Dempsey. And he points out about 75% of these tapes. So we don't know who Cheryl Dempsey is yet, but we are sure going to find out, because that's what a majority of this man's tapes are about. The field agent Leonard explains how at any given time, there are probably between 25 to 50 active serial killers in America alone. So it's not entirely uncommon. And then the analyst is talking a little bit more about the tapes and how some of them are just really random. Like he says that a significant number of these tapes have weird balloon stuff on them. And this is where we get one of our first tapes, because we see a clip of this, and it's a woman. She's wearing lingerie and she kneels down and she's like this, and starts like blowing up a balloon. So, okay. Yeah. It starts as some sexual thing. Sure. And then the next shot is of her like sitting on this balloon, bouncing on it. And she's like, oh, like this? Ha, ha, ha. Like, it's all fun and games. And then you just hear a man's voice go, pop it. And she goes, what? And he goes, pop it, and like yells at her. So she starts bouncing on this thing like harder to try and pop it, and it never pops, and it cuts before we see if it pops or not. And it's just like really bizarre. Then we get another title card, and this one says Part 2, The First Blood. So we know that we're about to now witness this man's first murder. We cut to another FBI profiler. This one's name is Mike, and he's teaching a class, and he's explaining to this class, like, after you see what we're about to show you today, there's probably three of you that will go home and decide that this is not what you want to do. Because he plans on showing them some of the tapes. The other profiler, then his interview pops up again, and he's explaining how whoever the serial killer is, something happened in his life. There was either some sort of fight or some divorce, and it kind of just made him snap and decide that the next vulnerable person that he sees is going to be dead. And that's when we cut to the tape of this man's first crime. So this man, whoever he is, approaches this little girl in her yard. She's sitting in her front yard, and she's just like playing with the doll, like minding her own fucking business, like 8-year-olds do. And he goes up to her and starts talking to her. You can tell that she's a little hesitant, and she just says, I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. And the guy's like, well, you're not supposed to have bad manners either. Like, bitch, are you fucking kidding me? And then he says something really unsettling. He goes, if I was the big bad wolf, there's nothing you can do about it. And then before you know it, he goes to like under the guise, show her the camera, and he just hits her over the fucking head with it. We don't see her actually get hit, but from the camera's POV, we see that obviously she is hit with this camera. And then we just see the person, whoever this is, start running and put her like unconscious body in the back of his car. I should also mention all the videos are from his POV, or if he's in them, he's wearing a mask. We never see this man's face throughout the whole movie. So the next few shots talk about this missing and eventually dead girl. So the officer explains how it was determined that she was hit with a blunt object eventually when they found her. And she was initially reported missing. Her name was Jennifer Gorman, and she was 8 years old. And it was reported that she was missing in the next county over from Poughkeepsie. Then we get a glimpse of the 911 call from Jennifer's mom. And obviously she's fucking frantic, and she's just screaming like, my daughter's gone and there's blood. And the fucking 911 operator is like, oh, you have to wait for 24 hours. Like, fuck you. And she screams. She's like, there's blood. Get somebody here right the fuck now. So then we get a present day interview with Jennifer's parents, who obviously seem fucking distraught over this whole thing. And the mom makes a comment saying, what kind of sick bastard rapes a little girl? So turns out her body was found. Like I said earlier, the police officer said she had been hit with a blunt object, and obviously there was signs of sexual assault. We cut back to the class where this video is being shown, and we can tell that some people are clearly very disturbed by it. And the profiler Mike just goes, this is nothing. He doesn't even know what he's doing yet. And that's when we get the next title card, which says Part 3, Getting Better. And we see another one of this man's heinous crimes. And this one is much worse. I don't want to say much worse, because like raping and killing a child is like literally the worst thing that you can do. But I mean much worse in terms of like, this one's just much more graphic in what we as an audience see. So once again, it's the killer's POV. And this time he goes up to a car, and it's this couple, and you can tell that he's hitchhiking, and they agree to drop him off at the next gas station or something. So he gets in the car, and he's like, do you mind if I film this? I'm kind of just like documenting my travels. And they're like, yeah, sure, no big deal. He introduces himself as Ed, and they introduce themselves as Frank and Jeanette. And he says, there's just a gas station off this exit. You guys can just drop me off there. That'd be great. So they're driving to the gas station. They're trying to make small talk, and they're like, where are you from? And Ed kind of ignores it. So from here on out, I'll refer to the killer as Ed, because that's what he gives his name as. So again, he kind of ignores the whole like, where are you from thing. And then all of a sudden, completely unprovoked, he fucking bashes Frank over the head. Mind you, Frank is the one driving the car. So the car starts to swerve. A struggle ensues. And the next shot we get is, so Ed is sitting behind Jeanette, who's in the passenger seat, and we see him like, we see his hand over her mouth with a cloth, so it's like he's chloroforming her, but the camera is in front of her face, but we still don't see him, so he's still out of view of the camera, but we see him chloroforming this woman. So then we see some news stories explaining this couple, Frank and Jeanette Anderson, who vanished, and they have absolutely no leads. So then we cut back to one of the profilers, and he's explaining how this guy really showed no impulsiveness, because this was obviously a very well thought out crime. And this is somebody who just figured out that he's very good at something. And then we get a clip of the video analyst, and he's explaining how that whole move had to be practiced. So the way that he was able to come around that woman's face, chloroform her, and then also come around with the camera while still staying out of view, he must have practiced that move a bunch of times before he got it down perfect. So then we cut back to the class where the other profiler is, and they're showing this video and he's explaining it, and he's talking about how calculated it was. So he knew where the next gas station was, he knew it was abandoned, and he already had an excuse for the camera, and he knew that this was going to be in a desolate area where he could get away with this. And one of the field agents goes on to explain that this guy is a mixed killer because he plots like an organized killer was. He's very calculated and who he targets and whatnot. However, he does with the bodies what a disorganized killer would do. And we see what he means by that in the next shot. And this was arguably the most disturbing shot of the whole movie. And that's why, again, I said this crime is worse than what the audience sees, because we get a close up of the woman, Jeanette. And now again, all the home video footage is very grainy and very pixelated, but you can still see what's going on. However, this is an almost blink and you'll miss it moment. So the killer approaches her and she's passed out, and he just starts saying, "Wake up, wake up." And it gets creepier and creepier as he says it more. And he's like, "Wake up, I have a surprise for you." And she wakes up and looks horrified, and he pans down to her stomach, and you can see that her stomach has been cut open and sewed back together, but is still partially open enough to see that there is a fucking human face in there. Because it turns out that Ed, the fucking sadistic ass killer, gave this woman a C-section, killed her husband by cutting his head off, and put it in her stomach and sewed her the fuck up. And we get a news footage, some news footage about how the remains were found, and they're talking to the coroner and whatever, coroner, and they're explaining how she had a head in her abdomen in almost a ceremonial fashion. Again, this is very much a blink and you'll miss it type moment, because that image of the head in the stomach, you almost won't see it unless you're looking for it. But when you notice it, it's horrific as fuck. So they found these tapes, obviously, in Poughkeepsie. However, this murder took place in Pittsburgh. So they mapped out the route from Pittsburgh to Poughkeepsie, and essentially they stopped at every single gas station on the only route that you can get directly from one town to the other. So they stopped at every single gas station and asked them for their security footage from when this couple was murdered. And that's how they got their first video image of the killer. So we see this image, and you can't see his face at all because he has a hat on. Again, it's very grainy, very pixelated, but we see that he's signing something, using sign language. So we cut back to the class where the profiler is teaching, and he's like, "Does anybody know what he's signing?" And somebody says, "Red House." So this killer is signing Red House, and it turns out that the second body was found behind the Red House Tavern. But the crazy thing is, he signed that in that gas station video before he even met the Andersons, which meant, once again, this man is very, very calculated. He knew exactly where he was going to meet somebody. He knew exactly where he would take them, and he knew exactly where he would dump the body. So the next part goes on to say how this killer, Ed, is very good at disposing of bodies, because they talk about another woman that he abducted and murdered. Her name was Elizabeth. So this is another victim of his. He cut off her head and her hands, and he dumped her torso in one county and then dumped her head and hands in another county. As they're talking about this, we're simultaneously getting video footage of this man cutting up body parts, and he's wearing a gas mask. So once again, we never see his face. However, we see him very brutally sawing at these body parts. Then we get an interview with a dismemberment expert, which I would love to know if this is a real thing. If it is, that's super fucking cool. How do I get into that? But he goes on to say that most killers don't think through their first murder. So they kill somebody and they decide that they have to dismember it, so they have a dull saw and it'll take them hours just to get through their head. But then the next time, if they're planning it, they'll get a better saw. But that's the thing with this guy, is that he always changed the type of saw that he used to dismember the bodies. So like one time he would use a handsaw, another time he would use a circular saw. So that's why they were never able initially to group together his killings. And the dismemberment expert is like, oh, maybe that's why he did it. Like, yeah, no shit.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Ah. Definitely some disgust.
Gross.
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
So this guy, again, a very smart killer, which makes for a very scary killer. And obviously the whole thing with leaving the head and hands in one county and the torso in the next county. There's another interview saying like counties barely fucking communicate with each other. And even if they did, it would still be hard to like put this together. That woman also goes on to explain how it's almost impressive how good he is at doing this, like with the whole like using a different saw to throw everybody off. And the interviewer asks her like, well, are you impressed? And she goes, absolutely not. Because after seeing what he did to Cheryl Dempsey, I have nothing but loathing for this man. And that's when we get our title card of part four, Cheryl Dempsey. So we see somebody filming a girl from a distance. You can tell, obviously, he's kind of like staking her out. Like she's not consenting to being filmed. I don't even think she knows that he's being filmed. And then he's outside a house next. Whoever's filming, who again, we know is Ed the killer. He's now filming outside a house. And he's able to like tap into her phone conversation. This is back in the day when we had landlines, kids. Somehow he has this device that's able to like tap into her conversation. And she's talking to a friend and she or her boyfriend or whatever. And she's just saying, do you ever get the feeling that something bad's going to happen? Ladies, always listen to your fucking instinct. Okay. So then we see this person who's filming entering this house and we see him get a knife and we see him walk through the house, walk upstairs and walk into a bedroom. And we hear the shower going. So we know that this person, who obviously is going to be Cheryl, is in the shower. And she hears like a creak and she calls out like Tim, who's her boyfriend. So she calls out to Tim and it turns out Tim responds, but Tim responds from downstairs because Tim just showed up. Now, Ed walks into the bathroom and he's exceptionally close to the shower where Cheryl is literally showering. And she makes a comment like, Tim, I know you're out there. Ha ha ha. And nothing ever comes from it. She doesn't open the shower curtain. She doesn't see him. He just sneaks right back out. So he sneaks back out and he sets up a camera in her room. And then we see him get into the closet. And it's just like such an eerie thing. And like, this is why I always check my closet and I always check under my bed when I fucking get into my house. I don't care if people think that's insane. I literally do that for this fucking reason. So Tim comes upstairs and brings Cheryl like a bowl of ice cream. And she says to him, why'd you move my clothes? And he's like, I didn't. And she ignores it. But we know that her clothes is moved because the killer moved it, because we saw it. So whatever, they move on. They start kissing. And then the camera cuts and the room is empty. But now we see the killer come out of the closet with a mask on. And he wears the creepiest fucking mask because it's one of those like, you know, like back during the plague days when the doctors would wear those masks with the long pointed beak. Like that's the fucking mask that he's wearing. It's so unsettling. So he grabs the camera and he walks downstairs and we see Cheryl and Tim sleeping on the couch. And he's literally just standing right over them. Like he's not even trying to hide the fact that he's in the house at this point. So he's kind of standing behind them and Cheryl wakes up and she's like, oh, Tim, wake up. We're falling asleep. Like we should go to bed. I'm just going to go brush my teeth, whatever. So Tim goes to the kitchen to put the bowls in the sink. And all of a sudden he looks up in the window and sure enough, he sees the reflection of the killer standing directly fucking behind him. So he turns around. There is a struggle, but ultimately the killer is able to knock Tim out. Cheryl hears the commotion and comes to see what's going on. And the killer turns around and we see Cheryl and she tries to make a run for it. However, she is unsuccessful. And we just see actually through a shadow. It's a kind of cool shot that the killer has her on the ground and just like punches her in the face and eventually knocks her out. And then he goes back to Tim, who's unconscious on the kitchen floor. And I don't know what he did. I believe he stomps his head in because all of a sudden you just hear this crunch and the camera goes black. So the next shot we get is a news broadcast and they're saying how like this nightmare happened for these local parents because they returned home where they had left their 19-year-old daughter, Cheryl, while they went out of town, and they came back to find her missing and her boyfriend murdered. Then we get an interview with one of Cheryl's friends, and she's saying how Cheryl said sometimes that she felt somebody was following her around, and I just told her that she was paranoid, which obviously, like, I'm sure you fucking regret that now, because she was not paranoid. The next scene we see is very disturbing because we get a shot, and this is the first tape that we get of Cheryl, and again, 75% of these, like, hundreds of tapes are Cheryl Dempsey, and the video we get is Cheryl hogtied, and when I mean hogtied, I mean, like, tied by the head and, like, head and hands all connecting into one. Almost like scorpion looking. So she's hogtied, she's crying, and we can make out her saying, "I'll do whatever you want." And the killer just says, "I know you will." And then he goes, "What's your name?" She says, "Cheryl." And he fucking punches her in the stomach, like in the side. And like, I feel like that's like honestly the worst place to get punched. Like, I think I'd rather get punched in the face. So she starts crying in pain, obviously. And once again, he goes, "What's your name?" She says, "Cheryl." And again, he fucking punches her in the side. And he goes, "Your name is Slave. What's your name?" And by the third time, she goes, "Slave. My name is Slave." Because obviously she just wants the fucking pain to stop and she's going to do whatever he says. So then we cut to an interview with one of the police officers that responded to the scene. And he talks about how gruesome Tim's body, like the condition of Tim's body was. And he explains how his head was crushed in, which we already knew. And then he was actually slit from anus to throat, and his intestines were pulled out and strewn all around. And then they also cut his genitals off and put them in a sock drawer upstairs. What the actual fuck is going through a person's mind when they do this shit? So basically he's saying, like, based on the condition of Tim's body, I had very little hope that Cheryl was alive, because obviously this person is a sick, sadistic fuck. So then another one of the investigators goes on to say how they thought that this was the work of a disorganized killer, just based on how, like, fucked up Tim's body was. But then now knowing what they know, they understand that he actually constructed the murder scene to mislead the police. So once again, this dude is incredibly fucking smart. And the agent, the field agent, also says that he is extremely mentally ill, which, no fucking shit. So then we get an interview of this guy. I don't want to call him a mime because he doesn't look like a mime and he's also speaking, but he's talking about Commedia dell'arte. And it's like a 16th century theater genre, and they used to wear these masks like the killer was wearing, and they actually called this character like Dottore Pesce or something, and it translated to the Doctor of the Plague, because again, they wear the masks that the doctors wore during the plague with the long beaks, and they're super fucking creepy. And this guy explains how people were wearing these masks and they stopped being responsible for their own actions, because the mask almost like removes any sense of guilt or any sense of like human responsibility. So the next scene, we once again get a shot of Cheryl being tortured, and she's tied up in what seems to be a basement this time. And she's tied up she has her hands chained like to the ceiling. And this always fucking kills me in horror movies. And she starts crying and says, "I want my mom." And like that, when people in horror movies say that, it's such an effective fucking thing to me. It makes me feel so fucking downright terrible for the person saying it. And it literally almost makes me cry. And like, I think it's because I love my own mom and I would probably do the same thing in this situation. Like, I can't imagine being in a situation like this. Like, all I would want was my mom. Like, this breaks me. When this happens in a fucking horror movie, it absolutely fucking breaks me. So Cheryl's crying. She says, "I want my mom." And Ed just fucking says, "I killed your mom." And Cheryl, like, kind of, obviously she's crying. And he goes, "I killed your whole family. I'm all you have left." And then she's crying more. And he goes up to her and he goes, "Tell me you're happy I killed your family." And she's like, "What? No." Like, she's crying. She's screaming. And he drags her to the fucking sink and dunks her fucking head in. Pulls her up again and is like, tell me you're happy I killed your family. She's like, no. Dunks her again, starts fucking drowning her, to the point where the next time she comes up, she's like, "I'm happy you killed my parents." And he goes, "You don't have parents, you're a slave." How fucking dehumanizing. And like, this whole thing happens and he's like, "Well, who do you like?" And she says, "You, only you." And he's like, "Why?" And she says, "Because you're the master." So this is the first time the term master comes up, and it's going to be consistent throughout. And then he's like, did you want me to kill those people? Like, I did that because of you. And obviously at this point, like, just because she's being tortured, she's like, yes, thank you. Like, you're the master. You did it because of me. Thank you. So we just see this woman just being absolutely fucking degraded and dehumanized and tortured, and it just gets so much worse. So we now cut back to another like news broadcast, and they're talking about like how the search for Cheryl Dempsey is ongoing, and we get a video of her mom like pleading with the killer, or like, whoever has my daughter, please bring her home. So obviously he was lying when he said to Cheryl, I killed your whole family, but Cheryl did not know that. So he did not kill her whole family, he only killed Tim. So we get that video of the mom, and then we get another video of the mom. However, it's from the POV now. It's a POV shot, and it's the fucking killer. And he approaches her and he says, if there's anything I can do to help. And she says, thank you. And then she looks at him and she just goes, wait, oh my God. And he starts laughing and fucking runs away. Then we get an interview present day with the mom, and she's like, I knew the moment I laid eyes on him, basically. Like, she just had an instinct. And she said, I play that moment in my head over and over again. I fucking looked him in the eyes and I didn't catch him or do anything about it because I was scared. So she like froze. Fucking fight or flight, man. It's real. Fight, flight, or freeze. Some people fucking freeze, and she froze. But this is how we get the first police sketch of the killer. Looks like any fucking average white man, so it's honestly not even really helpful. We once again get another shot of Cheryl being tortured. This time she's tied up again by her hands to the ceiling, and she has a ball gag in. And he asks if she needs water. She nods yes. So he starts to like pour the water on her face. Again, she has a fucking ball gag in, so it's not like it's doing much. And he just says, if I take the gag off, will you do something for me? And again, this poor girl being so desperate, like, nods yes. So the next shot, we see the ball gags out of her mouth, and she's not tied up. And she's in this like leather dress. It's like a leather corseted dress. And he gives her a mask, and she puts on the mask, and she just keeps repeating, you're the master, please let me serve you. So again, we just see this girl just fucking being like spiraling out of control and just completely being like the fucking toy and slave of her fucking captor. She has no other choice. So this happened, this whole thing actually happened, or it was supposed to have happened, back in the 90s. So then they talk about how in the summer of 93, the area started feeling the effects of the killer. And they explained that usually when people, like when people start to catch on or crimes start to get, you know, bigger in the news, three things will happen. The killer will either leave because they don't want to have a trace. The second is that they'll either like cool off and kind of chill out on killing for a little bit because they know people are looking for them. Or the third is that they'll keep killing until they get caught. However, this killer did something very different, because he kept killing, but he changed his MO. And this is where we get our next title card, which is part five, a new MO. And we get news reportings of the Water Street Butcher. And we learned that there is a killer in the area who is deemed the Water Street Butcher, and they are warning prostitutes to stay off the street because he is targeting sex workers. So we see another brief video of this guy, POV shot him approaching a sex worker, and the next shot is a very quick shot of her murdered and mutilated body in an open field. So then we get another video of Cheryl. This time it's a very close-up shot of her face, and she has that fucking mask on still, and we just hear her saying, over and over again, whispering, you are the master, you are the master, you are the master. And meanwhile, in the background, we can hear him slicing somebody up, fucking slicing somebody up. So they go on back to the whole like Water Street Butcher thing. And one of the police officers is saying how some of the sex workers were saying that girls were being arrested and never heard from again. So whoever this guy is, he's posing as a police officer. We cut back to the basement. We once again see Cheryl dressed up in this weird ass fucking outfit with the mask on, and there's another girl, and she's obviously in distress and she's crying for help, and Cheryl's just like, no, he won't like it, and she's just like watching. The killer comes downstairs and ties this girl to a pole. Heather, I don't know where the fuck that came from. Cheryl is not tied up at all, but he ties the other girl to a pole, and then he starts yelling at Cheryl because he's like, you told her to escape, like you told her to run. And Cheryl's like, no, I didn't. Cheryl was tied up. He now unties Cheryl, gives her the fucking knife, and we see a shot of Cheryl come up behind this other girl and slit her fucking throat. So now it's not only Ed killing people, he's making Cheryl kill people because she is so under his fucking control. She will do anything for him because she's so terrified. So Cheryl slits this fucking girl's throat and she dies. So then we get another interview explaining how the bodies were mutilated, and part of the reason that they're mutilated is to cover up bite marks. And it's also been determined that they were raped post-mortem. However, in the investigation on the bodies that they found, they actually found a matching sperm sample on a few different bodies. So now they have DNA. So we cut back to this class that's happening with the profiler, and he's explaining how he interviewed Ted Bundy back in his day, and he actually brought this case to Ted Bundy, because again, this would have been in the 90s, and Bundy, or the guy that's playing Bundy, obviously, is like, did he rape her? And Mike, the profiler, says yes, and he says before or after, and he's like, before or after what? And Bundy's like, dude, come on, before or after he killed her? And he says after, and he goes, okay, well, usually they'll return to the body. Ted Bundy obviously knows this from experience because he was a sick fuck, and he's like, they'll continue to return to the dump site and have sex with the body for like days after. So my suggestion is you stake out a dump site and you will find your killer. But turns out that they were never able to find a fresh enough body, as they put it. But he did indeed return, and there was evidence to show that he was returning, but they were never able to catch him. The next shot we get is what could have very easily been a disaster, but actually was not, because it's the POV shot, and we hear a knock on the door, and the killer goes to the door, and it's these two little Girl Scouts, like these two adorable little blonde girls, and you're like, oh my fucking God, like what is going to happen here? But it's these two little blonde girls, they're selling cookies, and he's like, oh, do you want to come in? And they're like, we're not supposed to. And he's like, that's okay, like that's a good idea, but I'm a policeman, so like you don't have to worry. Come in. Obviously, kids are fucking vulnerable, so they go in, they sit down, he gets them some sodas, and he starts asking some weird fucking questions, like, did you ride your bikes here? They're like, no, we live in the neighborhood. Well, do you tell your parents where you're going? Like, you can tell he's obviously trying to scope it out so he can know if he can kill these fucking girls or not. But then all of a sudden, they start hearing these like muffled screams and these muffled noises. He tries to explain it because the girls ask, like, what's that? And he's like, oh, I left the TV on in the basement, but it continues. And then his story changes to, oh, I have raccoons in the basement. You want to see? Like, no, you fucking weirdo. I don't want to go see your raccoons, idiot. One of the girls obviously is smart enough to understand that this is not a good situation. So she looks at the other girl and just says, I want to go. And Ed actually lets them go. The killer fucking lets them go. He's like, okay, let yourselves out. Meanwhile, in front of the killer was what we thought was like a coffee table, but he uncovers it and it turns out it's fucking Cheryl. It's fucking Cheryl in a box. And it turns out she was the one fucking making noise. And he was like, you felt pity for them. This is your fault. And she's like, no, master, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So then we cut back to one of the agents and he's explaining how they've now found a total of 10 bodies. However, six of those had matching semen on them. So they have the DNA of their guy. And then as they were investigating the apartment of one of the sex workers that had been murdered, they found a glass in it. And on that glass was the same DNA that was on the bodies. They found prints on that glass as well. And the DNA and the prints matched up to a man named Jim Foley. And he was the partner of the police officer that is being fucking interviewed right now. So it turns out this guy was a cop and he often would drive around undercover in the same exact neighborhood. And he was there at the time of all of the killings. He had no alibi because, again, he would just drive around in an unmarked police car by himself. So who's going to fucking vouch for him? So his DNA is on six of the bodies. And it turns out that three of the people that were killed in Pennsylvania, Jim Foley was in Pennsylvania at that same time. And they also ended up finding jewelry that belonged to some of the girls in his apartment. So they zero in on him, they arrest him, and they charge him as the Water Street fucking butcher. We get an interview with Jim's son, who's obviously like devastated, and he says that was like a devastating thing. I fucking dropped out of school, like I couldn't function. Turns out that this Jim Foley actually had a history of paying for sex workers too, so that didn't help his fucking case. And during his trial, one of the sex workers that worked in that area placed him in the area during three of the murders. They explain how Jim Foley refused to take a plea deal against his lawyer's advice. And because of that, he was ultimately found guilty and sentenced to death. And the next footage that we get is of Jim Foley's fucking execution. So there's like an execution recording and it's like a reenactment video. So it says, and we kind of get some of the videos of some of the murders and intertwined with like him being rolled into the lethal injection room. And ultimately, Jim Foley was killed by lethal injection on September 9th, 2001 at 12:24 a.m. And then we get our next title card, which is part six, Missed One. So Jim Foley's partner, I don't remember the guy's name, but his partner now speaks and he says, the day after Jim Foley was executed, I got a map in my mailbox with a marking on it and it just said Missed One. And when we went to that spot, we found another fucking body. Then we cut to another POV shot. Obviously, this is by the killer. And it's like he's out in public because it seems like a bar. He's sitting at like a table at a bar and he's filming the news report of Foley being put to death. And when he turns back to the table, we can see that Cheryl is sitting at the fucking table with him. So now Cheryl's out in public, but obviously, like, again, at this point, this poor girl is like so fucked up and so just like Stockholm syndrome that she obviously never even fucking went for help. So turns out that Ed, the real killer, framed Jim Foley because it said that Jim Foley possibly went to a fertility clinic years prior. So that might have been how he got the DNA. Or like my thought is maybe even like this is Jim Foley's son that he had by like, you know, somebody went to a sperm bank and had this kid. But regardless, they realized that Jim Foley was innocent. And when they went to go print in the newspaper that he had been exonerated and he was innocent, 9/11 happened. Because again, he was executed on September 9th, 2001, and then 9/11 happened a few days later. So the news article about his exoneration got bumped down to page six, and nobody ever heard that they found him innocent. So his son's talking about how fucked up it is, and another guy's talking about it, saying like, any other week, this would have been like national headlines, like ex-cop framed for murders and put to death. But because of 9/11, nobody gave a fuck. So in another interview, we see how they think that Ed took on the Water Street Butcher persona so that he could continue to prey on everyone. And we see what they mean in the next shot because we get the next video of the next victim. And Ed picks up a lady and it turns out her car died. She's on the side of the road and he's like, oh, I can drive you to the gas station. I don't mind. But I have a lot of stuff up here. You have to get in the back seat. And we can tell in his car that he has like what police have in their car, like that barrier thing, like the netting or whatever. So she assumes he's a cop because she says like, oh, thank you, officer, like whatever. So she gets in the back seat and he starts driving and he's like, oh, you definitely don't want to be out here with that Water Street Butcher. And she's like, oh, it's fine. He only targets prostitutes, like I'm okay. And that's what they mean by the whole like he took on this persona so he could continue to prey on everyone because not everybody else's guard is up. So he starts driving and then all of a sudden he passes the exit to the gas station that he's supposed to be driving her to. So we see that she gets a little uneasy. She's like, isn't that the exit? He's like, yep. She's like, oh, can't we turn around? And then he just goes, why'd you call me officer? And she's like, well, because you are. And he goes, I'm not a cop. And she goes, well, who are you? And he goes, I'm the butcher. So obviously at this point, she starts freaking out. She's like, that's not funny. He's like, I'm not fucking joking. And then he goes, you shouldn't get into strangers' cars, which is just like such a fucking slap in the face, I think. So she starts to cry and like plead and he goes, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to pull over and I'm going to rape you. I won't kill you if you behave and if you don't scream. And like how fucking horrific. Like this reminds me of the fucking toy box killer, not as badly, but the toy box killer, I would argue, is like the worst serial killer of all time because he's the one, it's like David Parker something. He would play his victims this like elaborate voice recording of himself that he had pre-recorded as they were tied up. And it would just explain like the horrific things that he was going to do to them. And I literally work in prison. Like I fucking deal with, I've heard really terrible shit, and that recording I regret listening to. There's nothing in this world that I regret listening to or watching except for that. I wish I could erase my memory of that recording. Because to put yourself in the position of being a woman who's just like helplessly tied to a fucking like dentist chair basically is what it would be, and like listen to this horrific like story basically of what's going to happen to you, like including like I'm gonna let all my friends like assault you and my fucking dog, like it fucked up shit. And just like there's something about being told about what's gonna happen to you that's so much fucking scarier than not being told. So this lady, like, back to the movie, this lady like agrees to it and he's like, oh come on, you think I believe you, like you're not just gonna let me rape you? And she's like, I will if you fucking let me go. And he just goes, and this is the other part that's so horrific, he goes, I don't think either of us are going to want you alive for the things I'm about to do to you. And that, again, is just, that's the most horrific fucking thing I could ever imagine it happening. And this lady just starts screaming, and we see him just get out of the car and, like, grab her, and it fucking cuts to black. Now, the next shot we get is of her tied up, and this is like the most iconic shot of this movie. And this is probably like if you've seen scenes of it on TikTok or if you've seen like a gif of it, like this used to, the gif like used to circulate fucking Tumblr all the time, and I remember people would be like, yeah, this is a real video. It's fucking not a real video. But so you get a close-up shot of this woman, she's tied up, she's got tape around her mouth, and in the background you see this person crawl into the camera. And now I say crawl, like they're on all fours, like hands and feet, but like kind of bridged. And they start walking on all fours towards this woman, but they're wearing a mask on the top of their head. So it looks so like inhuman and so unnatural. Like it looks like a person like looking up as they're like walking on their hands and feet towards this woman. It's really difficult to explain. But like if there's any scene you're going to like YouTube or search, like have it be this one. Or even if you search Poughkeepsie tapes, GIFs, like I guarantee this is the first thing that comes up. So he starts crawling towards her and obviously she's fucking terrified, and he gets behind her and he pulls out these like finger knives, like they're on his fingers. It's almost like the Freddy Krueger glove, but it's just on his like middle and index finger. And he just like takes them and fucking puts them in her fucking throat. And she bleeds out. Like, it's just a very slow, dragged out scene of this woman, like, bleeding from her mouth and fucking dying. So then we cut back to the original profiler that we had seen. And he's talking just again about, like, how fucking smart this guy is. He's like, he knows how to play the profile. And to prove that, I'm going to read to you some profiles that some different profilers made of this same person. And he starts reading them, and they're all fucking over the place. Like, they're so opposite. Like, they're like white male, 18 to 25. And then somebody else is like 25 to 35. And then somebody else is like black male. And he just goes over some other like conflicting things that they've said. So like organized, highly disorganized, messy, well-kept, highly educated, uneducated, probably never finished high school, probably has a job as like a police officer or maybe even an FBI profiler. And then somebody else says he's unemployed. And then after reading all this, the profiler kind of like looks at the camera and just like exhales. Because obviously, again, this guy is smart as fuck and nobody can get an exact profile on him. And then we get our final title card, which is part 7, found. So it turns out they used the map that the killer sent because it was printed out using MapQuest, which again, kids, if you don't know what that is, Google it. That's how we used to get around back in the day. And they looked at the records from MapQuest, and it turns out that there was only one download of this specific route. So they use that download and they track the IP address back to this house. Now we're getting an interview. This interview is by the officer who led the raid on the house, and we're getting the SWAT footage from when they went in the house. So they get in, they start clearing the house, and we get to one of the closets and we see all the tapes sitting there. So we know that that's where the tapes were found. And they explain how they didn't find him because he was not in that house. And like, we didn't even find him. He let us find him, because when we got to that house, there was not one fingerprint in the entire place. So he purposely led them there. He like wanted them to get there, probably to find the tapes, and he was out before they even got there. So he was never found. However, this is where it gets really horrific, as if it hasn't been already. But they're going through the house, they find some blood on the walls, they find 5 boxes so far of tapes, and then all of a sudden they're like, come in this room, we found something. And they pull out this coffin-like box. It's just like this wooden box. And they open it. And sure enough, is fucking Cheryl in that outfit she's been in this whole time. In that fucking like white-ass creepy mask. And they're like, she's still alive. We need medics in here immediately. Like, she is still alive. And we see her being carried out on a gurney. So then we get the news stories. And like the title is like, woman kept in sex dungeon, like, which is just so fucking horrific. And the mom does an interview and says, you know, when they called me and told me that they found Cheryl, I was expecting that they meant they found a body. Like, I had no idea that she was still going to be alive. So they get to footage and they're interviewing now the doctor in the hospital. And he's explaining how he's never seen a human show evidence of this type of torture. Like, this girl had broken bones. Some of the broken bones had been further aggravated by like tightening apparatuses. She was severely malnourished, so her organs were in bad shape, and she had also showed signs of severe sexual torture, including the electrocution of her genitals and other things that I wouldn't even say out loud, says the doctor. We then get an interview with the hospital psychiatrist, and she's explaining how the weird thing about Cheryl is that even though she was in the hospital, her injuries were actually getting worse, and we came to learn that it was because pain was such an important part and an essential part of this woman's life for the past few years since she's been held captive that she did not know how to exist without it. And they actually found that she was like torturing herself and hurting herself and self-mutilating when nobody was looking. We get another follow-up interview with that friend that we saw in the beginning, just saying like how hard it was to see the girl I loved and the girl who came back, because obviously they're two completely different people. And then we get an interview with Cheryl. So like the words on the screen explain how we reached out to Cheryl's parents and they agreed to let us have an interview with her. So we see Cheryl. She looks like still malnourished. Like her face is super skinny. She just looks like scared and like weak and frail. And she just is saying, I don't know what you want me to say. And she says that like two or three times. I don't know what you want me to say. And she's like, well, they're like, well, how did it feel to see your mom again? She's like, good. And then she's like, no, maybe not. I don't know what you want me to say. And you can tell that it's obviously because this girl, for the past few years since she's been being held captive, has been like controlled in every aspect and she has no autonomy left. And the interviewer then asks her, what was the man that held you captive? What was he like? And she kind of smiles and she just goes, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't think I want to do this anymore. And then her hand comes up to her head to scratch her head. And we see that her hand is just a stump. Like her hand is fucking gone. Like this girl is now missing limbs from the amount of fucking torture that he went through. And all of a sudden she just goes, he loved me, you know, like nobody lets me say it, but it's true. He didn't mean to leave me. He's going to come back and take me away. And she kind of just like smiles. And again, obviously now this proves the fact that this girl is completely Stockholm syndrome, completely fallen in love with her captor, and she's waiting for him to come back and take her. And then we get a pause and we see words come up on the screen saying 2 weeks later, Cheryl took her own life and she left a note. And in that note, she declared her undying love for her captor. This is just like so eerie to me. Like I just can't. Ugh, it's so fucking awful. Mostly because of the fact that like shit like this has actually happened. Like this movie was not based on one particular case, but it was based on kind of just like some famous serial killers in general. And like shit like this has actually happened and it's really fucked up and disturbing. So then we get another news broadcast. This time it's saying that Cheryl Dempsey's body was found to be stolen from her grave, and we believe that this was in connection to the Water Street Butcher. And in the coffin there was just a tape left, and we never find out what was on that tape. I wish we did. I almost wish, actually, like I like an ambiguous ending, but we never find out what was on that tape that was left. But so that opening scene of him like dragging the body out of the grave, that's fucking Cheryl. So he went back and he did take Cheryl. She did say he was going to come back for her. So, but then we get another interview with that field agent and he's explaining how I doubt that he stopped killing. Like maybe he stopped killing in this area. But I believe that he moved somewhere. And I believe that wherever he moved in some small town across America somewhere, the murder rates are rising and he's the one responsible. Now we cut back to the analyst and he explains how the tapes were in chronological order. However, there were 27 tapes that were missing, like 27 in between tapes that were missing. And they're speculating as to why they're missing. They're like, maybe they were too private. Maybe his face was visible. Maybe they revealed too much about him, or maybe they were worse than anything that could possibly be imagined by the human mind, basically like worse than anything else that was in any of these other tapes. This movie ends with something that I think is really eerie and a reason why I wish this had a theatrical release, because I think this would have been really effective, because it ends with that field agent saying, if this documentary that you're doing here gets to the theaters, just know that he'll see it as many times as possible. So wherever you are watching, just know that he'll be there. So it's almost like, especially because this was so real, and at the time, like, I'm sure people would have thought it was real, kind of like a Blair Witch thing. Imagine the fear that would have struck into people's souls thinking that this guy was fucking sitting next to them at the theater. Like, I really do wish that this had a better release, because I think this could be, this could have been like a cult classic. Like, I really do think that. But anyway, the last shot that we get of the movie is a home video of Cheryl younger. And it just ends with the words "for Cheryl Dempsey." And then it ends also saying, like, this is also in remembrance of all those that we lost. And it says, like, the names of people like Frank and Jeanette Anderson. So, like, if you only saw that part, this does seem very realistic. Just with the interviews and with the home video footage and whatnot, it does seem very realistic. But again, hate to break it to you, if you thought this was true, it is not a snuff film. This is all fake. In fact, it is so much not a snuff film that the actress who plays Cheryl, whose name is Stacey Chbosky, I think that's how you say it, is married to John Eric Dowdle, the writer and director. And she actually shows up in a lot of his films. So she has a credit for Devil and Quarantine, and she'll just play like a woman in passing or like a background actress. But they are indeed married. Her brother is also Stephen Chbosky, who is an author who wrote The Perks of Being a Wallflower. So that's something positive to end this really fucked up episode on. Personally, again, I really like this movie. I think it's a really good depiction of how sadistic people can fucking be. And I know people don't like to like acknowledge the fact that there's people like this in the world, but I'm sorry, there are. And hopefully there's people that are not this smart about it so that they can get caught. But if the killer in this movie really did exist, this would be a really terrifying fucking thing. I really like this movie. Again, I know people don't, because it has like really graphic depictions and it's just like violence against women for the most part. But again, I'm a fan of it. I like it. I think it's very effective. I think it's very tense. I think it's very sadistic, and it is disturbing. And I totally can understand why people would say that this is one of the more disturbing movies that they've ever seen, because again, it does feel very real. Overall for me, I'd probably give this one between like a 7 and 8 out of 10, 7.5, maybe we can go with that. So there you have it, baby, the Poughkeepsie Tapes. If you have been wanting to watch this movie and weren't able to, I hope maybe now you are able to, or I hope maybe now you have just satisfied your need to even know what it's about. However, if you do feel like you're brave enough and you do want to check it out, you can check it out for free on Tubi. As always, thanks for coming along with me. Appreciate you guys. Once again, not sure what I'm going to be doing next week, so we're just going to wing it. We're just going to see what I'm feeling. No idea. So until next time, you know where to find me, TikTok and Instagram, horror_chronicles. I post especially on TikTok pretty much every day. So until next time, watch more horror movies and stay spooky, my friends.